You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
David Goss is in my house. I will not let him sit on the furniture.
No.
He's sitting on the floor right now. Yeah. He doesn't get to have a chair anymore.
That's what I'm willing to do.
Hat trick for Deuce. Two hat tricks in four games.
Are you watching the games? Are you just looking at the stats?
Hodgepodge.
Yeah, there's a Modgepodge. Whole Modgepodge of rumors.
This is a transfer Modgepodge.
It is an ungodly mess.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about what I want to say.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio on SiriusXM FC, Channel 85 at MLSsoccer.com. I am Andrew Wiebe. With me, as always, back with the crew, David Goss, Matt the Armchair Analyst Doyle. Dave, you don't have a happy look on your face right now. You're a little annoyed.
I hate listening to the intro because I sound so eager in the two opening phrases where Doyle's like,
to sit on the floor.
He's sitting on the floor. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then you're like, David's sitting on the floor. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And it's like, what is wrong with you?
We gave him a chair today just so he can, just so he can feel good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Really excited about that.
Yeah, like a big show today. We are happy to welcome Matt Lampson in the second segment. If you haven't read his incredible, inspiring story, go to MLSsoccer.com. Our most recent Word long-form piece is on his battle with cancer, with Hodgkin's lymphoma. As a teenager, he won that battle, of course, and now as a professional goalkeeper, it is really inspiring stuff. His foundation, and I'll remind you of this over and over and over because it really is a worthy cause, is Lamp Strong. Lampstrong.com is the website. Remember, September is also Kick Childhood Cancer Awareness Month here at MLS. So a ton of stuff going on. Check out all of that at MLSsoccer.com. We'll talk to him in the second segment. Speaking of MLS soccer, though, 24 under 24, the annual series celebrating the best young players in MLS, starts next week. So prepare yourself for that. We've got a bunch of good stuff on the site right now. How to, be a successful pro. What are the attributes you need? Bobby Warshaw writing that one up. Will Parchman has got some really cool stuff on coaching education. And there's a whole lot more to come next week. So stay tuned for all of that. But the big news, and there is only one big news item today.
Yeah, obviously.
Pescadito.
The legend is,
he is back. I thought I made this up.
Probably going to lead the polling for 36 over 36. I'm just going to say. I mean, he's up there with Pirlo and Lampard and Drogba, I think.
I mean, his MLS resume definitely has him above those guys.
I don't know if we can get 36, but Doyle, that list has to happen.
Yeah, we've got to find a way to make that happen. Davey Arnault in retirement goes on that list for sure.
Zach Scott about to be in retirement. Uh-huh. Mr. Sounder himself. Uh-huh.
I mean, look. Two weeks ago, I'm watching Guatemala, Canada on a Saturday morning, a replay, because I'm an insane person. I tweeted out, FC Dallas, go sign Carlos Ruiz, do it right now. I thought I made it up. FC Dallas fans reamed me on a Saturday morning, which I thought was unkind, and all my dreams are coming true. So the question now is, what should I say that we test to see if it comes true in real life? What somebody suggested today on Twitter that I say that the Revs will win MLS Cup, and I said, I can't use my magic on something I don't believe in.
I think we should do a segment where you announce the DP signings from Minnesota and Atlanta
next week. Pretty good. I like that. I could get down with that. Send me your suggestions, and we'll try to make it happen, Minnesota and Atlanta.
Let's just make it clear, though. The Ruiz signing is very short term. I think Dallas announced that it's just for the rest of this year. So this is the equivalent of, like, a baseball team at the deadline going out and going like an extra middle reliever or something like that. We have not seen a ton of this in MLS in the past.
We haven't. It's like LaTroy Hawkins. You go out and get like the 45-year-old guy who just cannot walk away. Somehow, some way, is still effective. I mean, I'm pumped. I saw Carlos with Oscar Pareja this morning. FC Dallas put out a picture on Twitter. U.S. Open Cup winning coach Oscar Pareja, which we'll talk about in just 1 second, but somehow Ruiz trumped all that. And Carlos, he looks in shape, but he looks like he's got a little belly, which I'm a huge fan of you know, guys that are maybe a little bit chubby coming into the league and scoring goals. So Carlos, good luck. We're going to try to get him on the show. I mean, we've been talking about that forever as well. So
what's interesting is normally when a young coach takes over, like let's say Ben Olsen, when they first took over, there are guys he played with.
Yeah.
Pareja has been a coach for a while now, and they played together. It's like Pareja's just pulled this dude who's his homie, you know, out of the retirement home and is like, can you give me 45 minutes every once in a while? And he's like, no. He's like, I'll take 20.
the other great thing about this is like FC Dallas has been like a parade of the CONCACAF rogues gallery. They had Blas Perez last year. They have Carlos Ruiz this year. They'll probably have Carlo Costly next year. Like who else fits onto this list?
Well, they're definitely going to bring Joel Campbell back at some point.
Oh yes, that would be great.
I think Amado Guevara.
Yeah,
Amado Guevara should come off the Honduras bench.
Oh my god! Stop.
Look, Mauro Diaz. You never know. Sometimes he gets injured. Paxton Pomacol. It could be a while before he's ready for first team action. I think you give Guevara in there just to throw it around
and
a little bit.
This is a question I've always been curious about. If you're not a U.S. national team fan, or I assume we have a lot of Canadian listeners and some Mexican listeners, Mexican national team listeners and folks like that, who is the U.S. version of that? Just from my personal bubble, I assume it's Clint Dempsey, but I'm not.
Well, Landon not has to be up there for Mexico fans.
Yeah.
Just the legend?
Yeah.
With the peeing on the field thing and the push button couldn't, whatever.
Yeah, the commercials, dolls. You know, he's part of kind of the national consciousness when it comes to sporting misery as well as, like, some pop culture stuff. I mean, look, I can't be more pumped up that Carlos Ruiz is back in the league. I went and lit a bunch of candles at my shrine earlier when I heard he was signing. I mean, this is big stuff. And
I love how Taylor drops it casually, and it's like,
I know. Well, he did that, and I got really excited.
Yeah. It's like you realize you just gave a couple of people heart attacks, Taylor. You got to like preface stuff. With like, I'm about to say something huge in the history of Major League Soccer.
Right. Take some aspirin, and then I'll tell you what's coming here.
Aspirin.
Yeah, get some Bayer here going. Let's talk about the Open Cup. FC Dallas collected the second trophy of the season here in Major League Soccer, or at least competed for among Major League Soccer teams. Remember, Toronto FC won the Canadian Championship. A big victory against the Revs at home, 4-2. They celebrated. The celebrations were an awful lot of fun to watch. And, you know, the champagne in the locker room. And they did the big clap, the Iceland clap that the Sounders fans also do. But this was a...
You knew Sanders fans are coming after you.
Yeah.
Let's give credit where it's due before Aberdeen fans come after us. That's where that started.
Jeez.
It started in Aberdeen, I think, about 20 years ago.
You would, Doyle. So, you would.
Yeah, you're soccer historian Matt Doyle here.
Credit where it's due. Come on.
Went to his encyclopedias there. 4-2 win. Juan Agudelo with two goals. He actually started the scoring for the Revs, but Aruti got two goals in this match. Matt Hedges got a goal. Mauro Diaz got a goal. The consistent thing among all the goals that Mauro Diaz didn't score was that he basically set him up and put him on a platter. This game, if you didn't watch it, is one of those games where you walk away and you're just, if you weren't already in love with Mauro Diaz already and he wasn't your special unicorn as he is Doyle's, it was incredible. He's like a quarterback out there. He was pointing where he wanted his teammates to go and then just putting it on the money, and nobody could get anywhere close to him. There was a period in the second half where the Revs fouled him, I think like three or four times in a two-minute span. This was a special performance from Dallas. This is, it's not a coronation. It's definitely not that, Doyle, but it is proof in form of a trophy that what they're doing is working and that their potential is much bigger than this, I think.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the differences between this Dallas team and I think a lot of the great teams that we've seen in the past few years. Their whole core is guys in their early prime, guys age 23, 24, 25, like Mauro Diaz, like Matt Hedges, like Walker Zimmerman, who was huge in this game. Ryan Hollingshead overlapping from right back. And by the way, Oscar Pereja, please just play Ryan Hollingshead at right back from now on because he's excellent at that spot. And of course, Grezo and Acosta and Barrios. This team is set up to do this for a long, long time. And that's got to scare the rest of the Western Conference. And I hope what happens is that they become as successful off the field as they have been on the field, because this is the most exciting thing to me to watch this kind of incremental growth of a team, of a group of players, and maybe you sell one off every now and again, as they had to do with Fabian Castillo. But what's exciting about Dallas is that it looks like it's sustainable over many, many, many years. And I have to tie it into 24 under 24. The sheer volume of guys on the field who were on that short list for both the Revs and FC Dallas, that's exciting to know that you'll be able to watch these players play together for multiple years. It's something that I think has been lacking in MLS over the course of two decades.
No doubt about that. Dallas breaking the longest trophy drought in MLS. It had been since 1997. Jason Christ was a player on that team. Of course, he's a coach now. If we're talking about guys, you know, the span of time in this league and history. One of the most exciting things to me, Dave, was obviously it's cool to see their efforts rewarded. But I liked that after this game, Paxton Pomykal is on the field. He's their brand-new 16-year-old, string-pulling attacker, straight out of the home ground, straight out of the academy, a guy they're really hyped about. He's on the field, pumped, shaking hands, jumping up and down with guys, no doubt dreaming about the trophies that he's going to be trying to win as a first-team player with this club. I mean, the top to bottom, the stairway, the path to elite.
And the thing that Dallas will tell you is it's not a stairway because it's integrated. Paxton Pomykal signed with the first team, but he's been training with them for 2 years. He knows Mauro Diaz. You know, he knows Matt Hedges. These guys come out to the U17 games and cheer them on consistently. That's what the club's been so successful at. It's not an academy and a first team. It's a club. And that's what happens a lot of places overseas. And that's one of the ways Oscar Pereja has been able to convince so many good young players to come play with them, because he guarantees a relationship with him. He guarantees an opportunity with that first team. That's why Victor Ulloa came back, because he knew that Pereja would give him an opportunity, because he gave him one when he was a youth player. So I think that that part is, I agree with you, huge. And it's exciting to see. But I wasn't sure. I picked them to win, but the lineup comes out, and they lost their second best player, and they did not replace him.
Mm-hmm.
And Mauro Rosales is 35 years old. And their bench is Tesho Akindele and Jetterson, and I don't know if Colin Bonner was even on the bench. And you're thinking, if they're behind, what are they going to go to? And I thought it was huge to see Max Rudy step up in a big game. There may have been chances he should have finished, but the fact that he did in such a huge moment, that was big for me to see. And I think since Castillo's left, that was the first time I said, I think we could be going to Frisco for MLS Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was a moment where the young players stepped up, like Doyle said, they had never done it before, stepped up and said, we can shine in the big moment with the crowd here, with the pressure on.
Of course.
And it wasn't just that. It was they had a good game plan. Let's give Oscar Pereja credit, because the Revs came in that diamond that had been very, very good defensively for a few weeks, and they got on the front foot. They got the lead through Agudelo. What a spectacular goal that was. And FC Dallas said, you know what, we're not going to panic. We know that you can break a diamond apart with speed and relentlessness on the flanks and overlapping, and that's exactly what they did. And that was compounded, of course, by Gershon Kofi's injury. As soon as Kofi got injured, that game was over. I think Dallas was going to win anyway. Credit to both these teams, because Heaps could have gone in there and bunkered. He did not. He went in there for the win and made for a spectacular game, a lot of fun, and a deserving winner.
No doubt about that. FC Dallas sealing a CONCACAF Champions League spot for 17-18 with this victory. Toronto FC also have one via the Canadian Championship as well. We'll talk a little bit about some of the scenarios.
We'll trip over that later.
Yeah, the scenarios in the mailbag, because it gets really complicated. We started imagining some scenarios that would be pretty fun should they happen. Let's get to the weekend in MLS. Of course, we will talk to Matt Lamson in the second segment. The Chicago Fire will host DC United on Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Viernes de Football. That one's on Unimas. Make sure you tune in for that one. Chicago still alive in the playoff race. DC fighting to get above the red line. Should be a good game. Both teams resurgent recently. But let's go to Sunday, because it's a little bit of a mixture here. It's MLS and it's the NFL. MLS on Fox. It kind of depends on where in the country you are at. If it is on Fox in Canada, you'll just get it via MLS Live. But you can check MLSsoccer.com for all the details on TV. We won't go over all of it, so it's fairly complicated. It really does depend on what region you're in. Sporting Kansas City, LA Galaxy at 2 p.m. At 5 p.m., Toronto FC, New York Red Bulls, both great games. Both games I'll be watching. But I know there's a lot of people out there that Sunday's a family day. Sunday's a day where you go do something else. If you had to choose one of these two games, which one are you watching, Dave? Which one are you carving the time out for?
Oh, I was unprepared for that question. In terms of matchups, the TFC game, but if you want one thing to watch for, it's Ken Keane and Dos Santos play together. Can Bruce Arena get Keane on the field without hurting what's been the best form, I think, of anyone in Major League Soccer this season, which is Dos Santos over the last 3 weeks?
What about you, Doyle? Are you going to go the opposite way? I mean,
no, I'm 100% with Gasman on this one. I think, look, Sporting and LA have played twice this year. they have combined for a 1-1 tie and a scoreless tie. The Galaxy have taken 5 shots across 2 games. This, and if there are 2 coaches who don't give much of a damn about putting out an open product, and just because it's a national TV game, it's probably Peter Vermes and Bruce Arena. I think that one's going to be super cagey. I do have the same exact question Gasman does on Keane and Dos Santos. Dos Santos' numbers without Keane, he has 13 goals and 4 assists in 14 games without Robbie Keane. 13 goals and 4 assists in 14 games. Those are MVP. Those are beyond MVP numbers. Yep. And when he plays with Keane, I think in 12 games, it's 1 goal and 6 assists, or 1 goal and 7 assists. He's just a much less of a threat. Bruce Arena still got to figure it out.
Toronto FC Red Bulls, though. I mean, come on. This could be the battle for maybe Supporters' Shield, because Toronto FC are pushing that envelope right now. But certainly, I think, first place in the East. And at Toronto in that new stadium, it's going to be exciting. Josie Altidore, Brad Phillips, 2 of the best goal scorers in MLS, period. I mean, you talk about form right now. I know Gio's the guy that everybody's talking about, but Josie is 1A, maybe 1A-ish. He's right behind him right now. So that's a good game to watch as well. 5 p.m. Eastern on Fox for that. 2 p.m. Eastern for that SKC-LA Galaxy match. Let's talk about Saturday, and let's talk about some other big news. This time in Cascadia, we've got Seattle-Vancouver, 4 p.m. Eastern, TSN1 for our folks up north, MLS Live here in the U.S. Clint Dempsey is back in training, and the Sounders are saying that he could return before the end of the year. But for that to mean a whole lot playoff-wise, Seattle have to win this game. There's no doubt about it. This is a huge match for them. This is probably one it turns on. We talked last week about that Seattle-San Jose matchup and the swings, depending on what result you got. Well, Nicholas Lodero late on gets the goal to make it a 1-1 draw. They have to win this game. Vancouver went on the road last week and did it against Crew SC. Does Seattle win this game? Do they set themselves up for the next week, because that's all it is at this point. It's week to week to stay alive. Is this a game they win, Dave?
Yes.
Just straight up yes? Yeah. There's no hesitation there.
No, Vancouver, they got a couple goals, but it's a struggle for them to score. Seattle playing at home are going to have the energy. With or without Dempsey, right now it's all about Lodero still. And I can't see Vancouver scoring goals. Even with what
Wait. The Whitecaps have won 2 straight road games,
including CCL.
Right. CCL, and the visiting team has won the last 5 games in this series.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Seattle.
Still going Seattle? Yeah. He's going against the stats. Doyle, you just throwing stats out
Doyle,
there.
Doyle, you watching the game?
Yeah.
No, I believe Seattle's going to win as well, but I think it's look, a week and a half ago, I would have told you there's no chance for the Caps with the way they've been playing, but they kind of changed things up a little bit, and like Eric Hurtado took a beating after that Red Bulls game. But he came back, and he's scored in 2 straight games now. And give me a forward who can have a bad day in front of net, but still goes out there and does everything he can to get more chances. I like that from Eric Hurtado. I think he starts again, and we've seen guys with speed give the Seattle backline trouble all year.
Set up by Alfonso Davies, 15 years old, yep. Game-winning goal in CCL, as well as an assist. So even if you're not getting into the playoffs, there's something worth watching there for Vancouver.
Alfonso Davies, if you don't know that name, go look it up. Go research that, because he's going to be a guy maybe even next year, but certainly a couple years, that's going to have a very, very, very big impact on that Vancouver franchise. 6 p.m. on Saturday, Portland, Philadelphia, sticking in Cascadia. This is 2 teams that I think most people expect to be in the playoffs. I mean, you know, Portland's sitting on the edge there, but Philly should feel pretty good. Ridgewell's going to be rested. Nagby's going to be rested. Jewsbury's going to be rested. Powell's rested. They did not play in that CCL match midweek against Saprissa, which you may have noticed our guy, Dave, announced that bad boy. They lost 4-2, so that wasn't a great result for them in CCL, but they're still in pole position to get through. They just need to beat CD Dragon, I believe, on the road, Dave, and then draw against Saprissa at home.
They control their destiny against Saprissa at home, which I don't think is a mountain they can't climb.
Right.
They didn't put out a strong enough team in Saprissa to get a win, but they showed they had the quality, and Saprissa looked good, but I think in front of their home crowd, Portland is able to beat that team.
And in front of their home crowd, a crowd is huge here, because after this, Portland only have 1 home game left, and we know how much they struggle on the road.
Yeah, how many games have they won on the road, Matt?
I believe it's 0.
Yeah, I think it's zero.
Yeah, so they have to – look, they probably have to get all 3 points here, especially if there's a winner in that Seattle-Vancouver game.
The last thing I'm going to say about Portland – I think Darren Maddux might be big this season. He's doing more defensively than I think I've ever seen him do before, and that Rodney Wallace spot still hasn't been replaced. Milano's not performing, but if you have Maddux on one side, you can kind of deal with the other side. Nagby is back now, no more internationals for a while. So I think the pieces are starting to come together for Portland if Darren Maddux can give them a performance on the wing that they similar to what they were getting.
Yeah, I mean, look.
By the way, I do need to make one last point. Last night during the game, I was scrolling through my Facebook feed, and one of my friends called the announcer of the Portland game fairly competent, as opposed to usual. So I thought that was a nice compliment for you.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I think, you know, I'll give him fairly competent.
That's what I've always been striving
yeah,
for.
Yeah, this is the top of the heap of fairly competent folks. Two teams that have been pretty competent themselves, FC Dallas and New York FC, going to go at it on 7 p.m. on Saturday night. MLS Live for that one. Dallas coming to New York City. I've got tickets to that game. I'm looking forward to it.
You have tickets to that game?
I do.
Because I have tickets to that game, but I can't go, and I was going to give them to someone.
Yeah, well, I just got an email saying that I forgot I had tickets. So I must have requested those or bought them right when I had that Carlos Ruiz premonition. So it's all coming together here. I don't know if they'll have a U.S. Open Cup hangover in this one, Dallas, but at this point, you know, for them, I think it's about holding serve at home and moving on from there. Ultimately, MLS Cup is the big dream for them, and while they want the treble, Supporters Shield would be great. I think Oscar Pereja is going to look at this very pragmatically and say, whatever we got to do to set ourselves up for the playoffs, whatever we got to do to get a bye, that's what we do, and we don't overexert ourselves. We'll see what happens this match, what kind of lineups they throw out there. A bunch of other good games as well. Montreal, New England, if you want to watch that on Saturday night. Orlando, Columbus. Columbus trying to stay alive. Orlando trying to move up and stay above the red line. Colorado, San Jose. Quakes maybe on their last legs. They haven't looked great, but still in the running. They just need some results. And then RSL Houston finishing it off. That's what we got this weekend. Let us know what you think about the U.S. Open Cup, about Carlos Ruiz, about any game this weekend, the red line maybe, at Extra Time Radio, extratime@mlssoccer.com. When we come back, we will talk to Matt Lampson, cancer survivor.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime@mlssoccer.com or tweet at Extra Time Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
We are back on Extra Time Radio. I am Andrew Wiebe. With me, David Goss and Matt, the Armchair Analyst. As promised, Matt Lampson sat down with us for a really wide-ranging interview. We're going to go to that now. A cancer survivor and a goalkeeper for the Chicago Fire. Let's bring him on now. Chicago Fire goalkeeper Matt Lampson. Hopefully you've gone to MLSsoccer.com in the last couple days and read about his incredible story. Hodgkin's lymphoma at 17. Cancer-free, goes on to Ohio State, has an incredible career there, and of course now in MLS. You can follow along his journey on Twitter, at Lampstrong, or go to the website, lampstrong.com, donate some money, help some kids out. Matt, we're happy to have you here, man. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the plugs. That was big time.
We will continue to plug that. If you didn't hear it, lampstrong.com is where you should go. It really is a great cause.
Yeah, that sounds so nice.
And one that we're behind 100% here at MLS, of course. If people didn't read this, though, Matt, let's just start them out. Why you have a foundation, why you're here, 17 years old, diagnosed with cancer. Give me the story, the run-through here.
Yeah, so 17 years old, I was a senior in high school, and I was about to go off to college, go to play in college, and I was trying to get in shape, and I mean, I would go out and run, and 5 minutes into the run, I'm just gasping for air, and I just thought it was because I was a fat ass and out of shape, but it turns out that I had pretty advanced stage cancer. So that was one of the side effects. I actually found out after I tried to donate blood and just to the American Red Cross, and it was denied. So I went in general practice doctor, and they sent me home with antibiotics. Nothing changed after 2 weeks of antibiotics. So at that time, I had a biopsy of a really large lymph node in my neck, and that's when I got diagnosed. And started treatment.
Obviously, things have gone well, at least in, you know, it depends on how you look at them. You're cancer-free, and that's the most important thing. But you're 17 years old, and I'm thinking back to when I was 17 and the life that you lead at that age, and for a lot of people, it's pretty carefree. You're not really aware of some of the things, maybe some of the darker things that come with life. What did you think when this happened? And if I read the story correctly, your parents held the news back for a little while from you so that you could enjoy that initial college experience.
Yeah, I mean, unlike you, I wasn't rolling around with, rolling in the babes at 17 years old.
Don't make assumptions here, man.
I mean, when you're fighting for your life, you got other things to prioritize about. But, you know, once I found out, I just an initial positivity. I just asked, what can I do to beat this? And started treatment almost immediately because it was so advanced. So, it just really almost immediately shifts your priorities, immediately shifts what's truly important in your life. And especially at 17 and 18, those are really, important years, developmentally for people. I mean, that's when they figure out who they are, or when they're going off to college. So, I had to put all that on hold. And for that reason, I think I matured significantly quicker than other 17 and 18 year old, males. You know, I'm grateful because it's definitely made me who I am today and made me a much better person and goalkeeper.
So I was looking at some of the stats here as I'm editing this story and reading it, and so people know it was stage 4B Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I'm looking at, you know, the American Cancer Society puts out these quote-unquote survival odds, and the odds on stage 4 are 65% survival, but the flip side of that, of course, is 35% not survival. As a 17-year-old, how did you kind of compartmentalize all this? What was the support system like? How did you just jump into this two-footed, not to use a bad soccer analogy there, and really get after it without having that sort of downtime where you're really looking your life and your mortality in the face?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I never really looked at the statistics. I think that's not a good idea. You just got to take care of the task in front of you. And actually, not until I go back almost... I go back yearly for my cancer follow-up, and it wasn't until this past year that my oncologist said that it was probably worse than 65%. He was like, you know, if you didn't get treated how we treated you immediately when we treated you, it would have been lights out. So it wasn't, I mean, that's 8 years after the fact, and I didn't realize how serious it was until then. And I think that helped me in the long run. All I had was focusing on beating it, and whether that's metaphysical, whether that actually makes a difference, I think it does. The positivity, just knowing that you're going to beat it, is exactly what you need to do. And it's definitely humbling to know that your life is in the balance. But even during my treatment, seeing there's kids that are 6 months old to people that my age at 18, and just seeing those kids, I kind of lost focus on myself, and that's when I started to realize, like, these kids don't even know anything else. This is their whole life. I knew what was going on with me, but these six-year-old kids have no clue. All they know is being sick. So it was tough to see.
One of the kickers I thought when I was reading this piece was that your parents were both doctors. Now all three of your siblings, I believe, work in the medical industry.
Yeah, so I've got both my father's a doctor, my mother's a nurse. I've got two siblings that are oncologists, so cancer doctors for the layman, and one other sister that's in the medical field as well as a perfusionist. So I'm sure that it helps shape their careers, and it means a lot seeing what they've done for cancer, and it's humbling to know that my experiences have helped shape their careers.
Do you get poked and prodded, though, at dinner? Is there debates over what you should do?
What's really funny now, the chemotherapy that I received, they don't even use anymore. It's so toxic. It was the best they had 8 years ago, but that just shows how far cancer treatment's come, is that they don't even use the cancer treatment they used to save my life. And my sister now is a pediatric oncologist in Dallas, and she tells me all the time, like, I can't believe you got that. It's so bad for you. And I'm just like, you know, that's what we had at the time. And then my brother's an oncologist in Boston, and he'll say the flip side, like, you know, they had to treat you that way. There was no other way, stuff like that. So it's definitely funny when their whole career and expertise is in cancer treatment. But I'd like to think I'm an expert as well at this point, having gone through it. But I do find cancer biology fascinating. It's a big point of interest to me.
Let's talk about that chemo treatment, because one of the big kind of how to say this? What really stood out to me, Matt, when I'm reading this story, and sometimes words are not as powerful as images, were the images of you during and after, immediately after treatment, and you now. It almost looks like a completely different person, which makes sense when you're saying, you know, this treatment basically is killing you to allow you to live. How miserable was this for you at this time? How tough was it to get through what ended up being 6 rounds of chemo, each of them lasting weeks at a time? I mean, take me behind the treatment that you went through.
Yeah, I mean, you can call me a mutant. I know what you're thinking. But I definitely, it was miserable. It was probably the worst experiences I've ever had. It makes you feel like you're dying, honestly. It's destroying your red blood cells, destroying your white blood cells. Just the smallest things that you don't think about and take for granted throughout your entire life. Just for a while, I couldn't chew. My teeth hurt so much that I couldn't chew. Your skin cells are just deteriorating. Small cuts would just bleed, you know. And just the common cold is terrifying, because you have no white blood cells to fight off any infection. So not to mention all the nausea. That's on another level. And excruciating pain at times. I had terrible bone pain that to the point that I needed serious painkillers. And it's incredibly hard to describe to people not going through it, because it's like no other experience. But all I can say is it made me appreciate how healthy I am now, and I'm not even close to what I would have been had this never happened to me. So I take my personal fitness and health incredibly seriously now, just because I know how valuable it is and how quickly it can be taken away.
I thought it was pretty incredible that you still tried to play soccer, and you still tried to be with your teammates at the high school level as all this was going on and as you were being treated. And you said in the piece, this is not what doctors would advise me to do. How did you get out there? I mean, what was that like? What was your capability? I mean, and what did the game represent for you at that time as you're fighting this disease?
No, it was a horrible idea in hindsight. It would be like if you guys stepped out on the soccer field, right? I mean, what's your fitness level like right now?
I mean, you know, I get
not
some,
even close.
Get some men's league in.
Yeah,
but,
exactly, right? Yeah. You guys are lasting 30 seconds, okay? I'm lasting just about the same, okay? And it was brutal. When you think about, now I'm going to get biological on you guys. Your hemoglobin, which is the oxygen carrying capacity in your blood, when you have a lower red blood cell count, you now do not have the oxygen to take to your muscles to even move around. So when I'm out there playing soccer, I've got half the amount of oxygen going through my body as normal people do. So, I mean, I'm jogging one time and I'm taking an oxygen mask, and there better be a defibrillator out there. So it was a terrible, terrible time, because for as much as I wanted to play soccer, it was difficult for me.
But in hindsight, it didn't matter to me, because what I loved doing was playing soccer, and whether I lasted 30 seconds or not, I was happy, you know. Regardless of everything that was going on with me at that time, I was playing the sport that I loved, and it made me feel normal again. That's all I wanted. So it's something I would do every single time, regardless of whether the doctors wanted me to or not, because it's what kept me going.
You end up going to college. This was your senior year of high school. You go to college, Northern Illinois, and then you end up at Ohio State. Has that, at what point did you start to get back into shape? At what point were you able to really start to play at the level that you played at before?
So after treatment, I actually I had to take a whole year off of college. So I didn't go straight to Northern. I played with the Crew Academy, actually. And it took me about 8 months post-treatment to get back to competitive play again. I tried. Like, I went to trainings with the Crew Academy before that, and it was not good. But about 8 months in, I took over as the starter for the Crew Academy, and we went to the Academy Finals in the inaugural year of the Academy, and I did well. I did well, and that's when I really started to focus on my game. I think I took soccer for granted before, and I knew what I wanted to get out of every aspect of my life, and soccer being one of them. I needed to be the best I could be. And when I went to Northern, I just continued that mindset. I had way too many side effects from treatment still lingering. And I just wasn't happy in Northern Illinois, so I transferred. John Bloom was kind enough to allow me to walk on in the team, and I earned the starting spot as a redshirt freshman, and took over from there.
How did the relationship come up with the Crew? Had you been playing with them before you were diagnosed?
It was interesting. So because it was the inaugural year of the Academy, the club team, it was back in the State Cup days, and the club team I was on was the State Cup champions, and the Academy wanted to basically absorb our team. And so I just kind of became part of the team by default, you know. And so once I started playing with the Academy and really practicing with them, training with them, and then when I went to Ohio State, they brought me out to all their first team practices. So that's when I really started to realize, you know, there might be an option here to play pro. And with each year at Ohio State, I was getting better and better, and I knew that I was able to play at that level. And I think training with the first team consistently really helped me develop quicker than a lot of the counterparts, because that's a huge luxury to have, is to play at that speed and that level when you're 19 years old, you know.
Now, what were your doctors saying to you at this point? You come back, you've done these things, now you're in first-team training with a professional club, you're eyeing a career. I mean, you look at your stats and your plaudits at Ohio State, you had an incredible college career there. I don't think anybody would predict that you went through what you did. What were the doctors saying to you? Were they surprised by this?
They were definitely surprised. They knew that there would be limitations. Now, I don't remember telling them this, but allegedly, when I was first diagnosed, or maybe a few months into treatment, they tell me that I said, "I'll be a professional soccer player after this." Now, I don't recall saying that.
I mean, you were okay. Hopped up on drugs, so come on, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that could just be the chemotherapy talking. I don't know. But it's funny because, I mean, once I signed a professional contract, and I'm still going in there now to get follow-up appointments, they always remind me of that. They're like, it's incredible what you're doing, because they're just like, oh, okay, Matt, when I said that. So it's pretty incredible when I look back on it, but at the same time, I'm just happy to be living out I mean, I'm playing the game I love for a living, and it's not something you take for granted.
We mentioned off the top your organization, Lamb Strong, and go to the website and you can see. Tell us a little bit about what caused you to maybe start it. What's the goal for you personally of doing this? And I know through it you give talks and you meet with different cancer patients, cancer survivors. And what's maybe your big points that you give to them?
Yeah, so it's what started was once I turned professional, I know that professional athletes have a greater platform and footprint to reach more people. And kind of like what we're seeing right now with Colin Kaepernick, I mean, the guy takes a knee and everybody's talking about it because he's a professional athlete. So I'm trying to use my status for good. And I wanted to change as many lives as I could. That's essentially what I'm trying to do. I want to give people, give families, give patients, give survivors hope of what they can do following treatment. And that's what I want to do. I want to change as many lives as possible. And however I can do that, that's what I'm going to do. Obviously, I have the Hero program that I bring out survivors, families, patients to every single one of my home and away games. We have adolescent, young adult events that I give talks at, just to tell people my story and hopefully inspire. And there's always room for research, you know. They don't even use the chemotherapy I got, so things like that. And like I said, I just want to affect as many lives as possible and truly make a difference with my second chance of life that I have.
So we have a bunch of pictures that we included in this story, Matt, and one of the ones that I, you know, it's impossible not to look at this thing and not feel emotional and not get emotional. It's a young kid, and he's kind of, you're talking to him on the field, and he's in tears almost. He's close to breaking out in tears, and you can kind of see the connection that's made there. What's it like to interact with these kids? Like, as you said, know nothing but the disease. And what do they say to you? What do they, you know, what do you think that they get out of these things?
You know, it's incredible. It's palpable to see what goes through their mind. So a lot of them, especially the young ones, don't realize the connection until I show them my port scar. And it's when that happens that they're just like, you know, it looks like we're the exact same. That's what they're thinking. And then they see me out on the soccer field playing a sport for a living, and they're just like, you know, I can do that too. And that's what I want them to feel is, and whether it's soccer or living out their dream, something else, that's, you know, I'm so grateful for having this opportunity and hopefully changing as many lives as I can. And with every single hero, it's a different experience, and it means something different to each one. I know this weekend I'm actually going to have a family that just lost their son. This will be the first time that I've ever had a family that wanted to come and meet me just to pay the respects to the one they lost. And it's going to be an incredible experience for me.
Make sure you go support Matt's foundation, Lambstrong. Lambstrong.com is the website. You can follow him on Twitter, at Lambstrong. Also, this month, MLS is Childhood Cancer Month going on right now. So go out and support that as well. Let's talk about the Fire real quick, Matt, before we let you go here. 8 p.m. Eastern on Friday, you mentioned that game, Chicago hosting DC United. Not out of the playoffs yet, but it's been a season of frustration, I think you have to say, in the Windy City. After 2 years of not playing a minute with Crew SC, you've got 11 starts this year back playing and you know, some spot duty recently for Sean Johnson. Tell me about this season from a playing perspective from you personally, but also collectively as the team.
Yeah, I mean, coming into the season, obviously I was expecting Sean to start. Just because of all his pedigree, he's a great goalkeeper, and I did well enough in the preseason to start a good string of games. I think my play was consistently getting better. I think I played a lot of good games. And that's what happens as a goalkeeper is you get confidence. You get better with every game that you play, which I think is really important when you get a string of games. And honestly, I'm just trying to get better every single day. Goalkeepers are definitely going to get better as they age, and I'm trying to learn from every experience that I have. I'm trying to help Sean prepare for all the games that he's played. I want our team to win, and that's the bottom line. Whatever I can do to help this team win is what's most important. So the position of goalkeeper obviously is a tough one. You know, only one guy plays, and it's frustrating, but I've got to be there to support my teammates, and I know they're going to be there for when I play. So as a team, it's certainly been a frustrating year. I think we've certainly underachieved for what we the talent level we have, and I think it's just a sign of what we'll be doing in the near future and the rest of the season. I think we're really coming together as a team. I think we're playing well. Just honestly, a lot of times we've just been unlucky, losing leads, just poor mistakes that people take advantage of. And that, I guess that's the game of soccer, but, it's just been a frustrating year, but at the same time, I think we're really coming together, and we've got a great thing going here in Chicago, and it's all going to come together soon.
Looking for 3 points on Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, Chicago, DC United on Unimas, Viernes de Football. Tune in to that one. Matt, before we let you go, if you didn't read the story, folks, there's an anecdote in there. You went through 4 rounds of chemo, but the last two you didn't want to do. You were 18. You had the legal right to say no. Your parents bribed you with a Lexus, and now I'm hearing that this Lexus may be broken down, maybe done for good. I mean, that's tough, man. That's not a good morning for you today.
No, it might be done, I think that's just karma, you know. To this day, going through 2 more rounds of chemotherapy for a car is not worth it to me. And I think it's the fates just saying, you know what, we understand your car's not going to make it. It's time to move on. And we're going to have a nice ceremony for her. She's going to, we'll probably send her and do a trash compactor. Maybe, I might get a souvenir ring made from it or a necklace. And I'll definitely save the license plates. I'll send one pair of the front license plate. I'll send MLS for you guys.
We got a spot right here in the office. You said her, though. What's her name?
Oh, it's old Bessie. Old Bessie, not because she's definitely got some miles on her, and not in a promiscuous sense. I'm talking actual literal miles.
Old Bessie, maybe not continue on, but Matt Lampson, of course, is. You can read his story at MLSsoccer.com. Go check out his foundation, Lamstrong, Lamstrong.com, at Lamstrong on Twitter if you want to follow him. Matt, thank you so much, man. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Incredible stuff there from Matt Lampson. I don't know how you can listen to that and not feel inspired. Maybe do something with that inspiration at Lampstrong, Lampstrong.com. If you want to make a donation, of course, it's also Kick Childhood Cancer Month here at MLSsoccer.com and in MLS. So check out that awareness initiative as well. With that, we're headed to the mailbag.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email ExtraTime at MLSsoccer.com or tweet at ExtraTime Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Back now on Extra Time Radio.
Wait, why are you making a face?
Dave got special there. Choosing the mailbag music, we throw him a bone every now and then, and he generally goes with, is this Enrique?
No, Alvaro Soler.
Okay.
Dude, there's more than one artist in the world.
I know, but usually...
Be a little bit more open-minded,
look,
Andrew.
If it's not Ja Rule, I figure it's Enrique. So wow. We are into the mailbag. We got some stuff going down. First, a little bit of news. Benito Floro, we've kind of debated his fate with Canada on this show a couple different times. His contract basically was over once the World Cup dream was over for Canada. Of course, that happened after the semifinal round. He will not return, so they're looking for a new head coach. Jason DeVos has taken over their kind of developmental initiatives. They're making some changes at the Federation. It'll be interesting to see who shows up there. Matt, you got anybody off the top of the head? You're just going to moot them, just throw them out there? I mean, even if they're far-fetched. I've heard some people say Bob Bradley. I think they would be fortunate, super fortunate to get Bob Bradley. But anybody floating around in your brain?
Nobody yet. I mean, I hope they take a look at Robin Fraser, and I hope they take a look at a few other MLS guys. But I get the impression that the fan base really wants a European. And so I think that that is probably going to be taken into consideration at the CSA. But we'll see. And I think that, you know, in the coming months, we'll definitely try to have Daniel Scusato and Kurt Larson and a couple other experts on Canadian soccer on the show to talk about this, because it's going to be fascinating to see what they do. They have so much talent. They should absolutely be a hexagonal team at the least in 2022.
What do you got, Dave? Throw us into the mailbag here.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me for a name. I was like, I don't have any names. Let's talk expansion draft. Hi, guys. Writing in again as I'm baffled by the recent expansion draft announcement. How is it that Minnesota and Atlanta each get 5 picks when Orlando City and NYC each got 10 2 years ago? Not so dench. That's how he finished the email.
Nice. Who was really it? Like. We didn't get a name here.
CM, sorry.
Just CM?
All that's I got all is just... CM. It's okay. Not so dench.
All right.
CM Leota.
CM Leota, thank you for the email. Look, we're trying to dig into this right now as to why this is, why there are less picks. But if you remember some of the scuttlebutt leading up to this point, there were some people saying that there was a chance that there would not be an expansion draft this year. So it sounds to me like probably, and this is guesswork on my part right now, that it's a little bit of a compromise between existing clubs and the two that are coming in. And if you think back to previous expansion drafts, it's not as if you go out and get 10 players that are on your roster come opening day. That's not the way this thing works. Generally, it's an asset flip. You pick guys you think you can move on, or you pick guys that you know the team will give you some allocation for to get back, or maybe it's a prearranged deal with those teams. Hey, pick this guy, and we'll do it this way. So it was never 10 players. In this case, we'll see what happens. Maybe they get some extra allocation money, some reporting to be done around this. But October, I believe, 16th, I think, is the expansion, basically coin flip, where they get to decide who's on top of what order and who gets priority in the super draft and the NSL-USL player allocation. I mean, there's a lot to figure out here. And then in December will come the expansion draft. So that's always a lot of fun. We'll look forward to it. And if we have more information, we'll pass it on.
Let's move on to Nico, and he says, you guys keep talking about FC Dallas treble, but what about the TFC race for the treble? Voyagers Cup, Supporters Shield, and potential MLS Cup. I don't think we've mentioned this on this show.
I think I did last show.
Let's assume that you didn't, because you're probably okay. Wrong.
Yep.
I don't think we've mentioned this.
I've definitely mentioned it. I definitely mentioned it.
Oh, yeah. Doyle just waltzes in. Oh, yes, you, payasos. I have
look,
certainly.
There's less talk about it because TFC have not spent the entire season at or near the top of the standings, as Dallas have. But certainly now, with the much more favorable schedule, our friends at American Soccer Analysis actually have TFC as the favorites to win the Supporter Shield by a pretty slim statistical margin over FC Dallas, because at Dallas, they have a brutal schedule down the stretch here. 2 games against LA, a game at RSL. It's not going to be easy for them, especially if there's any kind of post Open Cup hangover.
Look, we waxed poetic about FC Dallas in the first segment. You know, US Open Cup, you have the trophy, hooray. But when you look at these two teams and you think about November and December, Toronto FC probably, I don't know, they would feel like the favorite between those two teams to me to go to MLS Cup and win it.
The only thing is Toronto has a history of failure,
well, yeah,
including a postseason last year.
Yeah.
And this Dallas team, while they haven't won an MLS
have
Cup,
built up.
Have had good playoffs.
Sure,
series.
Sure. And I get that. But Josie, full strength, let's just say that's the case. Bradley, Jovinko is back and rested because he's had all this time to kind of get his body right while he's recovering from injury. Their back line is good. They're going to have huge crowds, you would think, at their new remodeled BMO Field.
And they'll probably have an easier road in the Eastern Conference. Maybe not by much, but by a
little
bit.
I'm not sure about that. I actually think the top four teams in the East are better than the top four teams in the West.
I could see that the fourth place team in the East, you could say, is a tougher second round matchup.
I don't know. The Union and New York City FC have just been so inconsistent to me. Like,
that's true.
But I think the Union are a playoff team.
I agree.
But if you're talking I'm saying they're built for the playoffs.
Sure. Okay, top level teams though out West, if you're looking at the four, like Real Salt Lake, I think their attack is as good or better than just about any in the East. Rapids, still a wild card for me because who knows if they can score goals. I know they can keep you from doing it, but in the playoffs, if it dries up, I'm just not sure. L.A., but you're right, Doyle. I don't know. It's a crapshoot both ways. But if I had to bet on one team right now in the playoffs, I think it would be Toronto FC.
Also, and I
between
don't,
those two.
I'm now realizing over the last 4 days that I was the only one in this boat. I thought CCL was part of this. I wasn't actually totally aware that it was Supporter Shield, MLS Cup, and U.S. Open Cup for a treble. And so, first of all, Dallas has
domestic,
one more.
Domestic treble.
Yeah. Right. Well, no one has set. There's a tail in Doyle's face right now. I just looked over and I was like, what moved? I thought that that was part of it. So they also have a chance for four trophies when TFC only has a shot for three. So that makes it easier to get a treble, although I guess people aren't going to consider that a treble. I don't know. Clearly, I'm the only one in that boat because we talked about it last show.
You puzzled me here. Yeah.
Let's move on to a little bit of CONCACAF talk. You
sweet CONCACAF. What did I say?
You said that Eltry would be crazy to not call up Gio Dos Santos November 11th.
I did.
Eric Gomez said a little bit of open campaigning for Gio at Eltry. Doyle, you think that he has a chance to get back in the team?
I don't think so. I think Osorio is, you know, as inscrutable as Klinsmann with stuff like this. And once he makes up his mind, then he's made up his mind and that's that. But as a U.S. fan, the idea of facing a Mexico attack that has Chicharito and Eltry up Chicharito and Dos Santos up top, that's terrifying to me. So I'm glad that he's on the outside looking in.
There was I thought when the CONCACAF, like I agree with Matt, by the way, Osorio's not the sort that's going to reverse course, especially with the amount of pressure he's under. It would basically look like he was desperate and it would be a moment of weakness for him. I think it would. I think that's the way it would be interpreted.
But he didn't call him up when he wasn't playing well. Now he's playing well and he can call him up.
Yeah, maybe. But it would look like you're throwing a little bit of a Hail Mary, that you're saying the guys that we had and the way we were doing it clearly isn't good enough, which it probably hasn't been for Mexican standards.
Even though
recently.
They won their group.
Right.
And they lost 7-0. I mean, they lost 7-0 to Chile, and then they couldn't even beat a pretty bad Honduras team at home. I mean, things are bad for Mexico right now. They really are not great.
I would never call a team with Albert Elise in it bad. I am in love with that kid.
How many times have we said he should be in MLS?
I
know. I wish somebody would sign him 2 years ago. He won't be in the CCL this year, though.
He will
Monterrey
not be.
Is out. I thought you were going on that question, by the way, to CCL and the berths. I thought that's where we were going.
No, but we can talk about that now. Okay, we don't actually have a question. This is from David Gossin, Parts Unknown. And I'd like to say if
usually we just do David in Parts Unknown.
Oh. So I should hide my last
Harlem?
Name.
Yeah, David in Harlem.
In Harlem. I am in Harlem, by the way. I've done a lot of research over the last 2 days. Sugar Hill in Hamilton Heights in Harlem. So if Dallas wins the U.S. Open Cup and they win the Supporter Shield and Toronto FC are the first place team in the Eastern Conference and Dallas defeats Toronto FC in the MLS Cup, who is going to the CCL?
So we know that FC Dallas and Toronto FC are going. We said that because they've won their domestic championships already. But we did some looking around. We did some research. We parsed through the archives here in the MLS library. And it would just be the Supporter Shield standings. No, it would be just the American teams in the Supporter Shield standings, which is like the beef that Canadian fans have, that they just have the one spot for their three teams versus the four for the American side of MLS. So that's the way it would go. If, say, like RSL was the next down in Supporter Shield.
Well, let's look at it right now. New York Red Bulls are second with 44 points. Now, this isn't including games in hand and everything.
No,
for
we won't worry about that. That's
LA's on 47, Colorado's on 46, and RSL's on 44.
So
there is a
be
chance that four Western Conference teams all make it.
Yeah.
Which was the part that we were pretty unsure about. Doyle, do you have anything to add to that?
Nope.
Good. Last question from Mr. Evan in Parts Unknown. And he said, earlier today, I was explaining who Kristen Pulisic was to one of my friends
man, it's just all
who
about
lives
repetition.
Under a rock.
All about repetition.
I began to tell them that Pulisic has the chance to be the first world-class American men's field player before stopping myself and realizing I don't actually know what world-class means. Isn't the term world-class just soccer's version of quote-unquote elite quarterback? Talking heads go on about hours for it, but doesn't actually have a definition. So one question is, so what does world-class mean to Extra Time Radio? Who are current world-class players that we can point to as an example?
In the U.S.?
No. Okay, no. General. The second is, has the U.S. ever produced a world-class player? Was Donovan world-class? Was Howard, Friedel, or any of them world-class?
I think guaranteed the U.S. has, at least on the goalkeeper side, at the very least. I would also argue, and Matt, chime in at any time here, the fact that Clint Dempsey is so high up the international goal-scoring charts, and I know that that's against, you know, some of that's against CONCACAF, but he scored in World Cups. He scored against big teams. I would argue that those sort of plaudits in your career, as well as, you know, success at the club level, which he had at the highest level in Europe, put you in that boat. I'm not the sort of person that thinks there are three world-class number nines in the world, or there are, you know, it's a best 11 of world football, and to be world-class, you have to get into that group. I don't think that's the way it works. I think it's a big, you know, it's kind of a sum up of your career and where you stand at that given point.
So it's like a Hall of Fame type thing, or
yeah,
an all-star.
Kind of. And soccer's weird because it's not like there's one league. It's not the NFL where you're just like, there are these 32 teams and that's it. There's a big pool to choose from, and I don't know. It is a complicated question, though.
Doyle?
It is. I mean, I haven't put a ton of thought into it just because I don't care about the label that much. But if you look at what Donovan did from 2007 to 2011, I mean, that World Cup, he had three goals and an assist in four games. If you look at what he did in the Confederations Cup, if you look at what he did in World Cup qualifying, if you look at what he did when he went to Everton, when they had him those two half years, they collected points at a top three in the Premiership rate. And when they didn't have him, they were somewhere around ninth in the Premiership in points collected. He was player of the month at the club, I think three of his 4 months, and he was the best player in MLS. I think Donovan, I get why people are going to say he wasn't world-class, but I think those people are wrong. But if you ask me right now, does Christian Pulisic have a chance to be better than Landon Donovan? I would say yes, he does, which is a pretty high compliment.
Just to chime in, even though I read the email, I disagree with you. Like, Clint Dempsey is world class. I could get on board.
He has been world class.
Okay, I will disagree with that term with him. I think he had a phenomenal career in Europe, especially the Europa League run with Fulham and the years that he scored double digit goals.
Go watch that chip against Juve.
Yeah,
I'm not saying you.
Yeah.
I'm saying everybody.
Right,
it's amazing.
I still don't think he's on that level. I can get on board more with what Doyle was saying, that Donovan in his peak and Donovan as a player. Was
but wait. You're giving it to Donovan at his peak.
Yeah.
Are you basing it on Everton? I mean, Clint Dempsey did it for years. He's the player of the year for Fulham for years, dragging a team that's now mired in the championship.
I don't think there's ever been
the discussion, because it ends up being based upon what club you played at and what league you played at. And I get that there, like, look, the Premiership is unquestionably a better league than MLS, and was 6-7 years ago as well. But I think it's weighted improperly. It's weighted too much, because there's national team games count too. And the World Cup counts too. And if you look at Landon Donovan's record in the World Cup, it's better than Zlatan Ibrahimovic. It's better than Wayne Rooney. It's better than a lot of these guys. It's better than Cristiano Ronaldo. And I don't think anybody's arguing that they're not world class.
And I would also put in that I don't know that there's been a player in the last 40 to 50 years from Fulham that's been considered world class. So while he did do it there and he was their player of the year, I don't know that in itself
I'm not
is
saying
enough
that
to get
in
you
itself.
In the conversation.
My point was also the goals in the World Cups, the national team
goals.
Well,
you didn't have the stats like Doyle did.
Yeah, well,
it wasn't as convincing.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know the question was coming. All right, Dave. That's all we have here today. Thanks for listening. Big thanks to Matt Lampson. Go check out his foundation, Lampstrong, lampstrong.com, at Lampstrong on Twitter, and make sure you support Kick Childhood Cancer Awareness Month here with MLS. That's all we have. We will see you on Monday.
You're listening to Extra Time Radio.